We're starting?
We're starting! Hey everybody, it's F This Movie. Tonight we're effing 2010.
The whole year.
The whole year. We're gonna F the best movies of 2010. We promised it on last week's show. Now we're delivering. Because that's how we do.
I promised nothing on last week's
show. No, you weren't here, dick. The voice you're hearing is Doug.
Hi, I'm Doug.
And also joining us is JB.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, JB.
Before we get into the best movies of 2010, remember you can always find all of our shows and lists and wacky crap at fthismovie.blogspot.com, and you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. On last week's show, we put out a call for people to send in their 10 best lists. Last week we were talking about overrated, underrated, and ugly movies, which is kind of like a nice way of saying shitty movies. And this week we're talking about our top 10 for the year, but before we do that, I was going to read some of the submissions we got for top 10 lists for the year. John Petrilla, a regular contributor to F This Movie, wrote a very lengthy top 10 list, and I'm just going to read the titles mostly, because we don't have time to read everything here, but his top 10 is as follows. Number 10, Predators, aka the I Haven't Seen Black Swan or Blue Valentine Yet and I Needed a 10th Spot Movie. Number 9, Kick-Ass. Number 8, Shutter Island. Number 7, How to Train Your Dragon. Number 6, The Town. Number 5, True Grit. Number 4, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Number 3, Red Cliff.
Red what?
I'm going through pages here. And then
never heard of it. I only stick
in
to what's in the cinema.
For number 1, The King's Speech and Inception.
Ties are not allowed.
They're not.
John, come on.
I got to redo my whole list.
John Petrilla, ties.
Every
please.
Spot on my list has a three-way tie.
And I'd like to point out that even at this early stage in the game, we're already seeing the phenomenon that I predicted last week, that everyone's 10 best list is the exact same, plus or minus two films, all in a different order.
Right.
Right.
Get ready.
Because here's another one from Adam in Chicago. His top 10. Number 10, a three-way tie. Best worst
Fuck
movie.
That. That is. Stop reading right now. Screw that guy.
Best worst Adam, movie, Karate Kid, and Love and Other Drugs.
Wait, Karate Kid?
I'm just saying. I'm reading what he wrote.
I saw that in a plane, and I wanted to walk off.
Number 9, Mystery Team. Number 8, Hereafter. That's the first time I've seen Hereafter on a list. Number 7, Somewhere. Number 6, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Number 5, The Fighter. Number 4, Inception. Number 3, Fish Tank, which I haven't seen but really want to. Number 2, Black Swan. And number 1, The Social Network.
Proving, of course, that there are only 13 movies made this year.
And as long as we're talking about The Social Network, I want to read another email that we got based on, in response to our show last week.
Real quick, this podcast is really talky so far. It's
right?
Just a lot of talking.
Do you want to just kind of lay back?
I think we need to have more visuals.
All right, all right.
The talking.
We got an email from Ross in response to our Overrated Underrated show. And I want to read a part of his Overrated write-up. He says, Overrated, I'm going to take a lot of shit for this, but I'm going to say that The Social Network is the most overrated movie of the year. Maybe it's just me, but I enjoy my films to have an ending and resolution. You're Not an Asshole and Repeat Friend Requests listening to Magical Mystery Tour is not an ending. I also like to know whose point of view or story I'm following within a film. In The Social Network, I'm not quite sure if it's Mark Zuckerberg's story or if it's an ensemble piece. In fact, Zuckerberg disappears from the film in Eisenberg's one-dimensional monotone
one-dimensional works, though, too, I think. It was, because it was one-dimensional.
Monotone performance is nothing to marvel at. When you hear statements such as, it defines a generation and resembles Citizen Kane, you've already put into an unimaginable hype that will never completely satisfy anyone.
Who has said it speaks for a generation? Is that something that's said, that it's like Citizen Kane?
I haven't heard the Citizen Kane comparison, but I've definitely heard that this is a movie that very much speaks of this generation.
I've heard the Citizen Kane comparison, and I've...
From the letter, though, right?
No.
And me? Was it from me when I read the letter?
No. And I've read and heard that the reason why it might squeak by Inception for Best Picture is because the Academy thinks that voting for it would be hip and show that they're a part of the 21st century.
Because they're always focused on being hip. And
of course, you remember when The English Patient won.
Right.
My theory about the Academy Awards is they're always a couple years behind. So, for instance, the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever does not win Best Score. And then a year or two later,
the score
from Thank God It's Friday wins to make up for that egregious error.
That means that this year
the
Oscars,
by the way,
are going to give Best Picture to the MySpace movie. Anyway, I have some things to say in response to that letter, but we'll save it because I suspect that movie will come up sometime in this discussion. Let's get to our top 10 list. These are our 10 favorite movies of the year.
Possibly come up in this discussion. Is that on anyone's top 10 list?
Citizen Kane is my number one. It's very good.
Might I suggest that in the spirit of the podcast we did last week, that as we go through...
I'm lost already. I wasn't here last week. Oh, but I listened to
it. But you listened to it.
I did, in fact.
As we go through the list, let's all go in ascending order. And if someone else mentions a film that you put on your list, you cross it off. And then when we get to that place on your list, you just mention it because it will already have been discussed.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because, as I said, these are the same lists.
Wait, so ascending is from starting at one?
No, because one is the best. We're starting at 10. So
right.
There's sort of a
descending, though? Or am I a complete dummy right now?
Wouldn't descending be going from 1 to 10?
I'm not going to respond because I want this discussion to go on for a lot longer.
Okay, we're starting at 10.
We're starting at 10.
Let's just agree.
Okay, ready?
We're starting at 10.
1, 2, 3, go.
Up in the air. Yes.
This is going to be the best podcast ever.
Number 11. Wait, what?
Number 10, I have a three-way tie. Ramona and Jesus.
F that tie in the A.
Yeah.
My number 10 is The Green Hornet, and here is why. Because I love coughing, and I love Seth Rogen, and I love Chinaman. Need I say more?
Is that term still acceptable?
I was just going to say, for a politically incorrect podcast, I think we've just hit a new level of political incorrectness.
With
Chinaman? What are you, 97?
They helped us build the railroads.
Do I not have a Chinaman's chance of making it through this podcast? Chinaman? Oh, my God.
All right. I'll drop Green Hornet if it makes you happy.
Please stick around for the end of the podcast when Doug starts throwing around the N-word.
Okay. Number 10, Doug. Coming in at number 10.
It's not Inception. What is it? Hold on.
In Bruges.
No, go with...
Good Company.
Okay, my number 10 is
In the Company of Men.
It's in
the bedroom.
It's The Company Men. It's Ramona and Beezus. No, it's not. I've not seen The Company Men. It's Iron Man 2.
Okay.
And I know that it was discussed at last week's podcast, and I know it's overrated. I know it's the ugly. I know many people consider it to be...
I don't think that was the ugly.
The shit. Not... Wait, overrated. Sorry. Correction. Not the shit, but shit.
It wasn't the ugly. And
okay.
Again, there's the Book of Eli phenomenon. There's the it's such a bad year, everyone's list is pretty much the same. And there's a third phenomenon,
which
Patrick alluded to last week.
Patrick alludes to many things. Please clarify.
That everyone found it very easy this year to come up with 6... maybe 7.
Yeah.
But positions 8, 9, and 10 were harder.
I feel...
And that's what we're looking
for. I feel bad because, honestly, I was making this yesterday, and actually Shadi made a list, too, which was great because she never made a list.
Do you want to read it?
Yeah, her number 10 is...
Ramona and Beezus.
It's Ramona and Beezus. But no, I really struggled because I was a lot of good movies that I was considering. For example, I was considering Cyrus. I know that's... because it's like an interesting movie that I've thought about a lot. I don't think it's necessarily a good movie, which I also...
What would have made it better, do you think? Like, how could that movie have been
I think the
improved?
Ending, if it was different, might have been better.
How should they have ended it?
I think if the garage door opened and someone was found hanging...
Okay.
Hanged.
You're mocking me. This is a reference to the Summer podcast.
By the way, you should listen to the Summer podcast.
Yeah.
That's the way I thought the film was going to end, and maybe that's nuts.
That's how this podcast is going to end, if you keep it up.
Maybe that's nuts, but I think for the film to be what it set out to be, A, it needed a darker ending, and B, the ending that we have has studio note and preview screening comment cards written all over
it. I agree with all of this.
What we're saying is, it should not have been your number 10.
I'm just saying, I think it's funny that he's defending his Cyrus ending.
Here's why. I'm not only defending my Cyrus ending, Cyrus very nearly made my list.
Okay, my point is this. First of all, I'd like to apologize, because you're starting with me with we have three top 10 lists. You're starting with me, and I'm putting Iron Man 2 out there. People are listening to this.
Good, that's something
different. And
they're saying,
Iron Man 2,
that's a piece of shit not going to be on our list.
Absolutely, and I completely acknowledge it. People think it's a piece of garbage, and in a lot of ways it is. And my biggest fault with that movie is that there's a middle part of it where he invents an element. And that to me is egregious, and I find that offensive, and I'm being dead serious right now, that he invents an element, and he does it fairly casually.
Number 6 or 7?
Absolutely.
Even
no.
Robert Downey Jr.
But here's
he
my,
can do a lot.
Here's my reasoning.
He can smoke so much crap.
Here's my reasoning, is that a lot of movies that were on the cusp of this, and this one made it because when I saw it in the theater, I really enjoyed my experience. I know that's a really cheesy, lame thing to say, but I really had a lot of fun. I had no expectations. In fact, my expectations were lowered so much because I think of you two, because you had seen it and you thought it was not very good.
That being said, I think at this point, people are listening to the podcast. They hear that Doug's number 10 film is Iron Man 2, and they shut off the podcast and say, never again.
It's very possible, and I apologize to those who aren't listening anymore, but I really had a lot of fun. For example, I also was on the fence with Green Book, but I enjoyed Green Book, but I don't think about it ever, and Iron Man 2 I just really enjoyed.
It was a bad year, as we've said, and there were, 7 or 8 really good movies, and then in those last spots, you have to, if you had fun during Iron Man 2, fun was hard to come by in 2010.
I had a lot of fun, and I also liked at the end, there's a big battle. As most action movies end with a battle.
Yeah.
And this battle was...
I thought it should have ended with an argument. just two characters...
Just get in the car!
...who are cross with each other.
I wanted it to end in a whimper instead of a bang.
But I like that the fight at the end was not this drawn-out CGI. Yeah. It was over quickly, and I really was like, yeah, I don't need to sit through everything. I've seen this a million times before.
And there were critics who said it went on forever. And when I went to see it, I was surprised by how brief it was.
Yeah, so I like that. And so Iron Man 2, sorry, mea culpa.
My number 10 is chosen for very similar reasons, and I went with The Town.
That was close also.
Directed by Ben Affleck.
Oh, I like him.
For sort of the same reasons. I've talked about it before on the show. It's a solid movie, not a great movie. It is the movie that should be the standard for Hollywood. Every movie should be at least as good as The Town, and then great movies should be better than The Town. But again, it was a bad year, and there were other movies I considered putting in that spot, but I thought about what movie that I find entertaining and just really well made, and what movie do I think I'm going to return to a number of times in the future, and I can see myself watching The Town a bunch more times, because it combines a lot of things that I like. So... not a great movie, just a really good one. Number 10.
And The Town almost made my list for exactly the same reason. I liked it a lot. I'm looking forward to the cut on the DVD is longer. It's an extended cut. I'm looking forward to seeing the longer version.
It's
my top 10 film. And again, very, very difficult to rank this year. And so I started to try to rank them in some way. And by no means do I mean to say that now I'm awake. Kick-Ass was my number 10 film, mostly because I was trying to rank in some order now that I don't quite understand, but I'm not suggesting Kick-Ass is bad. I'm suggesting that Kick-Ass was one of the 10 best films of the year in a year that was really, really bad. We've talked about Kick-Ass before on previous podcasts.
Not really.
You talked about it briefly in the last podcast, but it really hasn't
Didn't we bring it up for the summer one?
No, because it didn't come out in the summer. It came out in the spring.
Okay, very misunderstood. Critics saw it, and I think a lot of critics had the same reaction as they did to Scott Pilgrim. They overreacted. I know Roger Ebert being the most egregious example of sort of focusing on one part of the film and saying, well, that's horrible or naughty or immoral or something. And I think films consistently show us things that are immoral. I think what it does to the comic book movie is really interesting. I thought the film was honestly very funny. I thought Nicolas Cage gives a performance that harkens back. You mentioned this in an article that you wrote for F This Movie recently, that at least in The Rock, we get one of his batshit crazy good performances rather than his lazy, phoned-in action hero performances. And the examples I've been using in class are not only the fake Adam West-type voice he uses when he's the superhero, which really had the audience we saw it with on the floor, but I would argue later in the film he has quite the acting challenge. He has to act while he's on fire. He's ablaze. He's aflame. And he has to shout very specific
spoilers
instructions.
Oh, Jesus. he's hanging in a garage.
He's on fire. You just mean, like, he's doing great.
Yeah. No, he's literally aflame. And he has to shout very specific instructions to his daughter to save her life. And that's a difficult acting challenge. And I think he nails it. I think it'd be very hard to do anything while you're on fire.
He's great in that movie.
The way the film handles the idea of what it means to be a superhero, or even better, I think it was my favorite scene in the entire film, when this unfortunate man is being beaten up, and everyone in the diner, all they can think to do is take pictures of it and video of it with their cell phones, and no one comes to help. I don't think it was a silly film. I don't think it was a flippant film. I think it was a film that was very aware of what it was trying to be about and did a really good job. And a great line: with no power comes no responsibility.
Sorry, I saw it recently, and I liked it for the first time, and I liked it. And I also, Patrick and I briefly talked about this the other day. I really think that I tried to see as much as I possibly could this year in the theater, but there's a few things I saw at home, including The Town and Kick-Ass and a couple other ones. And I really...
Inception.
no, I saw that in the
Ramona
theater.
And Beezus.
Ramona and Beezus. I saw it at home, and I think at home, obviously, you're much more comfortable pausing and walking away and being distracted by things. I wish I had seen it in the theater, because what I saw at home, I liked a lot, but I wasn't as crazy about it as you two were. And I know, like in previous conversations, just from, and again, hearing you talk right now, that you loved it. You thought it was really, really great. And I read Ebert's review, and I've read some other reviews and stuff, and I don't necessarily agree. I find myself squarely in the middle while still liking it. Like, I still find it very interesting. I just wanted it to, I know this sounds really dumb. I just wanted it to be, like, funnier or just slicker. Or I don't know what the adjective I'm looking for is, but I almost, like, at the end, one of the characters says, "Wait till they get a load of me." And I realize that's in, you know, a reference to another line in a movie. But it's I try not to give too much away. Well, he's on fire when the man is dying. you know, so one of the characters says that, and it's in reference, it's, you know, obviously kind of sets up maybe a sequel. Balls to the Wall, I think, is a possible title. Kick-Ass 2, Balls to the Wall, I saw on IMDb.
I had students who actually went to see it and walked out.
That seems odd.
It was not the film they were expecting.
And I'm not even offended by, if you read about this movie, and I think people that listen probably have seen it or at least know about it, there's violence towards kids, I guess, is what Ebert's biggest thing is, or his biggest problem with it is.
And I thought it was interesting that Edgar Wright said that he wanted you to regard the fight scenes in Scott Pilgrim like the musical numbers in a musical. And I think if we sort of apply that to Kick-Ass, you're looking at a couple action sequences that are among the best action sequences I've ever seen. And interestingly enough, Ebert singled out the library hallway massacre near the end of the film as being some a new low in screen violence or something, and I thought the cleverness with which it was choreographed and shot and the visual invention they came up with was sort of reminded me of Buster Keaton. I thought it was very, very well done. I thought it was sort of looking at that through the wrong lens.
This isn't my argument, but do you have a problem with the violence towards children in the movie?
Not at all.
Why do you think Ebert does, and why don't you? I know I'm not trying to... I like the movie. I'm not...
It's a very disturbing image. I think it's a very transgressive image. He specifically pointed out, spoiler alert, the moment where Nicolas Cage shoots a small girl point blank in the chest. But I think the film, in its subtext, I think the film in its intelligence, I think the film in its theme, earns the right to show you that scene, especially in the context that it's in. This is a film that doesn't pretend that violence doesn't hurt. This is a film that actually, for all of its visual invention and sort of stylization, shows violence the way it really is. There's a reason why some of the action sequences are crazy wire work, and other action sequences are disturbingly realistic. And I think they did that on purpose. The scene where the head bad guy beats up... what's her name?
Hit Girl.
Hit Girl. is very disturbing. And if you watch that and you say, I hate this movie because that's disturbing, well, in a weird way, the filmmakers have won because they wanted it to be disturbing. So much like my initial reaction to Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, Ebert's review proves that the filmmakers won, that they did what they were setting out to do.
Okay. It was all a dream is what I'm learning. My only problem with that is it seems like they're having their cake and the other part of that expression, meaning that it's
having another cake.
They're having two cakes is what they're doing. Maybe three, maybe four.
Okay.
It's showing violence, but it's also glorifying. It's also celebrating. And it's, I don't know. There's something about that scene. I know that maybe I fall into that group a little bit. And again, I like the movie, but there's something about that scene where I don't know if it's, good to watch.
And I think the film would answer that concern.
My number one choice, good to watch.
Both in the original.
No, I don't mean like it's I mean like literally like I don't know if I should be seeing this. Right, like right. You know, it's
at the beginning of the film.
Despite what it might teach me or what I might learn from it, it's like this is I don't want to see anyone. I don't want to see a person getting raped. I don't want to see this, you know.
At the beginning of the film, we have a
don't
character
in Beezus.
At the beginning of the film, we see a character who thinks they're a superhero, and we find out what might happen. So it's like the film begins acknowledging that that might be the case. But also, and I'm not sure if Patrick and I have discussed this on a podcast or just privately, that the scene where the kick-ass character goes out for the first time and ends up in the emergency room,
right.
I think is the film acknowledging
right.
what you're talking about. Now, okay. At this point, we've talked about our number 10 film, and we've gone for 22 minutes. Now, by my clock...
However, this movie is probably the most... this is a very... What are we going to say about the King's Speech, really? This movie is something...
I'm literally going to say nothing
about it. I'm going to stammer my way through an address about the King's Speech that will rally the English people to my cause. And my cause is defeating the Nazis.
Douglas, okay. What is your number 9 choice for the best movie of 2010?
Just
best
also
movies of 2010.
Quickly a clarification. I'm realizing your rules, John pointed out the rules for this podcast he wants to apply, is that I think that your number 1 movies might not be mine. So I'm not going to say anything. We're going to wait till we get to number 1 for yours. That's what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Hold on. I wasn't ready for this. What are we talking about?
Number 9.
Number 9.
Number 9.
Exit Through the Gift Shop.
Okay.
A documentary about the street artist Banksy.
Banksy.
I saw it just recently on the Netflix On Demand or whatever it's called. Instant Netflix Instant. And I really, really liked it. I thought it was both fun and confusing and intriguing. I did more research after I saw it. If nothing else, and I put this on here, and I'll reveal my hand. I put this on here... almost because I just want to get the word out and say that this movie is worth seeing, even if it's not necessarily your favorite or, you know, it's a documentary. I know a lot of that turns off some people.
It's made a lot of critics' 10 best list. I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't either, and I keep wanting to watch it on Netflix. I did see Catfish, which is the other documentary this year that kind of plays with these ideas of, like, what's real and what's not. No, I'm just saying I might have backed the wrong horse.
Oh.
I didn't hate Catfish, but I think I wish I would have seen Exit Through the Gift Shop if I could only have seen one of them.
And it's really...
And I did only see
one. To your point with Catfish, it's like what's, you know, and there's a... And I won't ruin it because obviously you two have not seen it, but you've read enough about this movie to know that there's an element of it that's like, what is real? What is what's going on? Is this a documentary? Is it fake? Is it, you know, and it's
Are
really
we dreaming?
Just right. Is it a dream in our heads? I don't even know if it's a dream in our heads.
Dana Stevens on Slate did something this year that was very interesting when it was a film for which she had nothing but disdain. She offered a review that had optional spoilers, encouraging you to scroll over the text so that the spoilers would be revealed and then you wouldn't have to see the film. She had such withering disdain for The Tourist. She did that for The Tourist. And she also did that for Catfish, which she felt was a film that was intellectually dishonest.
Okay.
Your number 9.
My number 9 is Black Swan, which I think will be coming up again later. I obviously we spoke about it last week. JB, not so much a fan. I liked it, and I the more I read about it, the more I hear critics sort of talking about how it's this brilliant sort of meditation on creativity and dedication to art, and that is all probably true. I didn't necessarily see it that way. I watched it almost as a horror movie, and as a horror movie, I enjoyed it, particularly. And Doug and I spoke of this after he saw it, and I won't give it away now. But there's a point in the movie where it really reaches its peak of craziness. And that was probably my favorite shot, and I know you weren't as big a fan of that single shot, but
right.
I think it's good. I think it's getting crazy amounts of attention, and I already want to see it again just to revisit like what I think of it. I don't know,
right?
Because
someone
the movie that's being written about isn't the movie that I remember.
Someone posted on F This Movie's Facebook page.
Yes.
I don't know his name. It was a newer, I think, a newer member of
it was
the
a woman, I believe,
a
Joyce.
Woman. Maybe it could be a man named Joyce.
Sure.
Don't pigeonhole Joyce's out there.
Richard Harris was in that movie, right? A man called Joyce?
I believe so. And they said it was the...
It's going to be the new Showgirls.
The new Showgirls, which...
It is, oddly enough, already being very much embraced by the gay community because of its, I think, theatricality.
Hence the reason it's so high on my list.
But I'd like to go back to something Patrick said because, again, I'm alone in this, standing in the corner. The reviews that I've read that make the most sense to me are the reviews that approach it as a horror film.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's much more successful as a horror film than a meditation on...
Yeah, that does seem... And I'm a big fan of the movie. That, to me, just seems like film school, you know...
Right. Well,
gobbledygook.
Justify
but film
their...
school gobbledygook, and I don't... I
say it.
Isn't that what we're doing?
Film school gobbledygook is
that was
what,
the original name for this podcast.
I never went to school.
That was the original title of Black Swan. Film school gobbledygook is what Darren Aronofsky excels at. And one of the things I actually give him credit for, there's some very interesting filmy things in the movie that I think are aces. It's like, did you notice that? I mean, after the film, I asked my wife, did you notice that? And it was like, no, I didn't. That was very clever.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the first 5 minutes of the film.
And then
the next time you watch it, watch the first 5 minutes. Ooh, it looks like footage that hasn't been played with. It's been played with a lot.
Oh, cool. All
right. My number 9 film was Shutter Island,
mm-hmm.
which I had a very positive and visceral reaction to. And then the critics weren't sure when it came out. And now all the reviews I read are people are rethinking it. And I don't know. It's Martin Scorsese. I don't think it's the greatest film he's ever made, but I call this Scorsese's Hitchcock film. It's
mm-hmm.
very much like a Hitchcock film,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I thought when I saw it in February, and now people are comparing it the most to Vertigo. They're saying that Martin Scorsese's Vertigo. In a weird way, and I don't say this very often, I thought it was worth seeing just for the cinematography. It's a very beautiful film to look at. It has very saturated colors, like a Technicolor film from the early 50s. And we all know that Scorsese likes to play these stylistic exercises, like the weird color at the beginning of The Aviator, and I saw this as a continuation of that. Didn't have a problem with the twist. I liked the performances. I thought it was great.
Seeing it the first time, I knew right away that I needed to see it again. And I have not done so. But I remember admiring the technique a lot and not so much the screenplay. But
interesting performance from Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's good.
But I need to see it again. Douglas, your number 8.
My number 8 is The Fighter.
Yes.
David Mick O'Flanicutty O'Russell, director, the Taiwanese master, David O'Russell. Directing The Fighter. I just saw this weekend, and I really enjoyed it. It was a lot more fun. I know that's a silly adjective, but it's a lot more fun than I thought it would be. And I know when I watched the previews, it reminded me of like an Aaron Brockovich type, like basic story tale.
I've seen this movie.
Right.
100 times.
Absolutely. And I was more intrigued just because it was David O. Russell and because I like his other movies for the most part. And I saw it, and I had a lot of fun. And I also like fight movies, and I enjoyed watching that stuff. And it was good. I liked it.
Yeah, I really liked it way more than I thought I would. I had the same sort of feeling about it going into it, which was I've seen this so many times. I'm not that into boxing necessarily or boxing movies, but I
like David the sweet science.
I like David O. Russell, so I'll give it a shot. And I was amazed at how entertaining it is and how involving it is. And the boxing stuff, you know, is sort of the least interesting stuff to me. And I really liked all the performances and all the character stuff. And it's funny, which I didn't expect it to be.
Yeah, that was the big surprise.
It made me like Christian Bale, which I haven't done maybe since American Psycho.
Good for you.
Oh, good for you.
And I thought David O. Russell directed the hell out of it and borrowed a lot from Scorsese. As soon as Can You Hear Me Knockin' came on, it was like, well, at least he's acknowledging it. So, yeah, I thought it was great, and it will come up again very shortly.
And it's interesting what you guys are saying, because that's exactly what's kept me from seeing it, that I've seen this movie before, and I'm not that big of a fan, but obviously I've read all the reviews, and all the reviews are the same. We weren't expecting to like this. There was a mini debate going on a week or two ago on the Slate Movie Club, where one of the critics involved in that was trying to argue that it's not really about boxing, that it's about family relationships and the decisions one makes about the family relationships. Obviously, I'm going to see it. I haven't seen it yet. It's a boxing movie. My number 8.
Yeah, wait. No, I didn't do my number 8, right? Was that your number 8, Doug?
I think so.
Okay, my number 8, I'll go quick, is...
Let me see my list again. Oh, nope. My number 8 was Ramona and Beezus. Sorry. My mistake.
My number 8 is How to Train Your Dragon, which surprised the hell out of me, because, again, I had no interest in seeing that movie. I am very burned out on the computer-animated kids film... DreamWorks, unless it's from Pixar, you know, because DreamWorks has never really blown me away with any of their stuff. It's all very...
Unless it's from Pixar and doesn't feature cars as spies.
They're spies?
And then in Cars 2.
They're spies in Japan.
Oh, God.
Brilliant.
How can we ruin this?
I'm going to line up at my Fandango.
And it's, you know, sort of medieval fantasy Viking nonsense.
You love
so
that stuff.
I just had no interest in it. And I saw it and really, really loved it and really appreciated how... sophisticated it is, not just the technique, but the storytelling. I thought, and this is probably going to be an unpopular position, but I thought this movie did Pixar better than Pixar did this year. Again, I really like Toy Story 3, but it is not on my top 10. I thought How to Train Your Dragon felt a lot like a Pixar movie in how mature it is. It's DreamWorks. I didn't get the name of the director.
Did you see it with your son? Or
no.
You just saw it?
No. Okay. I'm an adult who saw How to Train Your Dragon.
And oddly enough,
gotcha.
It's getting it's on a lot of critics' 10 best lists for the year. And again, I ignored it because it's one of those – it seemed disguised as one of those movies that I have no interest in. A computer animated film for children with a lot of fart and pee-pee jokes.
And it has none of that. It has none of that.
To your point, yeah, it looked like Monsters vs. Aliens or looked like some other, you know.
It is so much better than
Tales of Desperado.
Any non-Pixar kids movie that has come out in like 10 years. It's really great, and if you've been avoiding it for the reasons that we just outlined, you should definitely see it. I really loved it.
I skipped that in favor of Alpha and Omega, which is my number -1.
My number 8, we've discussed at some length. Patrick did a whole podcast on it. I'm now wondering why it isn't higher on my list, but the ranking is ridiculous. My number 8 film is Scott Pilgrim versus the World, and had a minor wonderful moment today in class. I had been talking about the film with my students and urging them to see it because, like me, a lot of them missed it originally because they thought, well, this is silliness about fighting. And I was talking about it in terms of what I felt it was about. And a couple of my students saw it over the weekend and said, well, actually, one of them said, you were in my brain, which was very disturbing. And I made sure that the student clarified that she saw what I was talking about and agreed. That what that film is about is much more wonderful and life-affirming than fighting. My number 8 film is Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Oh, no. Oh, no. What are we on?
7?
Yep. 7. My number 7 is The Social...
I was going to ask if it rhymes with Shmushmona and Shmeezes.
My number 7 is The Social Network. I also saw it this weekend, and I really liked it. Any other comments?
Well, I know I was going to say that it comes out on DVD tomorrow.
Right. It'll be out by the time people hear
it. And if you want to save it, because I realize it's kind of high on my list, if you want to save that, because again, save it for your...
I'm just wondering if I feel that movies like Inception or Scott Pilgrim will hold up to repeated viewings. I'm not sure about Social Network. It'll be interesting to see what the repeatability factor is on Social Network, and we can start finding out tomorrow.
Don't you think it speaks for a generation, though? It speaks for my generation?
I think it will hold up.
Are you talking about that generation, MySpace movie
generation
that came
me?
Out at the picture show?
It's actually about Friendster, thank you very much.
I was going to get me some saltwater taffy and go see the MySpace movie, because you know I'm on the World Wide Web now.
I think it will hold up only because the screenplay is so dense and because it is sort of, I think, very much a movie that speaks to where we are right now, that even in 10 years you can look back and say, I mean, it might seem quaint, but it's like, yeah, that's where we were. The movie it reminds me of more than Citizen Kane, which again I hadn't heard, is... All the President's Men.
I heard the Citizen King thing, though. Oh, that was earlier today when you read a letter from
No,
Ross.
No, no. It was when JB was talking about...
Reading the letter from Ross?
Yeah, having me... Yeah, me okay. reading
That's where I heard it from, but I had never heard that before then.
Yeah. What is Citizen Kane, by the way?
I first met Charles Foster Kane in 1919.
I really like Aaron Sorkin a lot. I'm a huge fan of The West Wing.
Huge fan of Charlie Wilson's War.
Charlie Wilson's War.
I was going to say that he wrote the Social Network script to officially publicly apologize for Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. A show that my wife and I used to watch to make fun of.
I like West Wing specifically, the seasons he was a part of. And David Fincher is great, although I guess Benjamin Button was not. All that great.
It's kind of a misstep for him, but
I really enjoyed all the. I actually thought Jesse Eisenberg's performance was great. And
so did I.
Maybe I'm completely out of left field.
I thought
here.
It was very different from his other performances, but subtly different.
I think
it's easy to say that it's one note. Not to attack the letter that we got, but I think it's easy to say, well, it's just one note and monotone. But I think that's dismissing so much else that goes into that performance,
and that contributes that. That performance and the way it's been stylized is part of the point the film is making, that there's a quality to Mark Zuckerberg that makes it a very disturbing prospect that he invented what is now the most popular website in the world.
Right. I think it's easy to say, like, I can do that performance. I can talk like a nerd and be quick and be aloof and whatever else. But I think to actually do it and to do it consistently is a feat. And I really enjoyed it. In a way that it made me uncomfortable, but the movie does a lot of good tricks. It like you want to side with him in certain instances, and you want to hate him the next scene.
Right, yeah, it doesn't make him just one thing. And I think the trick to appreciating his performance is watch him in a scene when he's not talking, because it's a movie filled with smart people who talk very fast and say intelligent, interesting things, and yet even when he's standing off on the side of the screen not speaking, you can see that he's thinking so much faster than anybody else on screen, and that is not an easy thing to pull off.
I also like, this is such a dumb kind of reason to like this movie, I like East Coast, like the Ivy League feel of things, and I like to kind of dive into that.
You would really like The Town.
I really like Harvard,
Ivy
man.
League, right?
But I know
Stealing Harvard. Did you ever see that?
What I liked,
that's funny.
What I liked about it was that I was in this world and so fully and completely
Soul Man.
In Soul Man. What are we talking about? I was so I was so completely in the Social Network.
Network
that it was this world that I'm not very familiar with because I didn't go to Ivy League schools. And yes, John.
And I'm looking forward to Oscar season because I guarantee the clip they're going to show again and again and again is the scene where Eisenberg reads the lawyer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The monologue about how much attention he needs to pay. Because I really like that scene a lot.
Yeah.
And Doug saw three movies in one day, and two of them
day.
We already talked about.
It was
Social
a great
Network,
day.
The Social Network and The Fighter. There's another one that I'm guessing will come up later. But you had made the point afterwards that all three movies not only told interesting stories and had good performances and were well made, but that each took you very much into a specific place.
Yeah, and even, I don't know, subculture is the right word, but there's
sense
such a
of where they're located.
It's not just a movie that could have taken place anywhere. It had to take place there. It had to be under those conditions and all that stuff. And obviously, because it's based on a true story.
And they're all very different.
Right. And if anything, if I have one critique about this movie, and it's very minor, and I love the fact that Justin Timberlake is playing Sean Parker, the creator of Napster, but. And I also understand that him as a movie, as a celebrity in his own right, Justin Timberlake's a famous person in this movie, brings the celebrity that Sean Parker, is that his name? I think it's his name.
Yeah, yeah.
That brings to the, that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg looking at Sean Parker as a kind of a god. But whenever Justin Timberlake talks, not whenever, but there's certain instances when he talks, it just, it feels like he's acting. It feels like, I'm going to deliver this line like an actor, as opposed to watching.
You know what's cooler than $1 million?
Right, exactly.
Well, they showed that
bring it on down on the bill
on the commercial, but I actually give Timberlake a lot of credit for that performance because I think there's an aspect in the film that Parker is acting, and what I liked about it so much, and we've seen this in lots and lots of other movies. I'm watching the film, and I turn to my wife very early on when he's introduced, and I say, "He's Satan."
Yeah,
this is the Mephistopheles.
But that's
story.
Not very subtle. I mean, that obviously the other character, Eduardo, is like onto him from the very beginning. And my point is, I enjoyed it and I really liked him. But if nothing else, especially because I had seen The Fighter, for example, with Christian Bale's performance, which is ridiculous. And you watch that performance and I'm like, it's apples and oranges. You can't compare the two. But when I watch Justin Timberlake act, it's kind of like, oh, he wants to get into acting, you know, and that's a minor comment.
I'm very excited to see it again.
And one more thing to mention real quickly about The Social Network. The amazing special effects that let one actor play the twins. And I would argue that that's when special effects are really good, when you can't tell.
Absolutely. However,
it's seamless.
But what's the point? And I get the point is because he's such a good actor that they want to cast him as these twins. But like, it just seems so gimmicky to me. It seems like such a like a trick that like, look what we can do.
But I think if you weren't told in some way, I don't think you'd figure it out. I really don't think you would.
I completely agree, but it still, to me, seems like Fincher in doing his, you know, I'm going to flex my CGI muscles. And
What I liken it to is I remember seeing Contact, and of course that movie has a lot of obvious special effects in it.
I just saw that again like a week and a half ago.
But then listening to the audio commentary, Zemeckis tells you all sorts of interesting things like, we didn't like the sky that day, so we replaced it.
Yeah, and he does the same thing in a Castaway, and everything is Zemeckis, he changes everything, and I guess you can, I just don't. It seems kind of gimmicky.
I think it's truly a special effect when it tricks you,
right.
And it doesn't call attention to itself.
Yep.
Army Hammer.
My number seven movie we just talked about, it's The Fighter, a movie I liked so much
Did
more.
Did we just talk about that?
I just liked it so much more than I ever thought I would, and I don't need to say anything else about it.
Wait for the kick.
Oh, sorry.
Wait for it. Wait for the kick.
My number seven film was Howl. I think I talked about it at some length last week, and I was amazed that it didn't get bigger distribution, because I think with James Franco in it, they could have advertised it in a certain way. But of course, the minute most people say, oh, that's about poetry, next. An amazing film about the creative spirit, an amazing film about an amazing man and an amazing poem, and it was great.
Yeah, you talking about it last week makes me want to see it. I missed it when it was in the theater for the day it was in the theater. So,
it's true.
As soon as you said it was about poetry, I knew I didn't want to see it.
I know, poetry's lame. I hate poetry.
Right?
Poetry's the worst, Patrick.
Yeah.
It also premiered on pay-per-view the day it opened in theaters, and at this point, JB hands
what?
Douglas the Blu-ray.
My God,
Howl.
My birthday is so... This is for me to keep, right?
No, it's not.
What?
No, it's we're recording this. It's on record.
Yeah, but I think you said I'm handing this to Doug.
If you think that's a gift, you're dreaming.
Thank you, JB. I'll put it right here in my little bag.
He really does have a bag, everyone. Douglas, we're at your number six.
True Grit!
All right.
Number six is True Grit. I saw it in the theater. That's right.
Whoa.
Jealous
on the big
much?
Screen?
Absolutely.
I saw it in the theater with Doug. On the same night. He wouldn't let me sit anywhere near him.
I didn't.
He had some
That's because
thing about
he
a personal space zone.
Doug's big on sitting front row. He
I've
loves
got rules.
To sit in the front row.
Well, that's you can see the things better. I have bad eyes. Thank you very much.
True Grit is on my list as well.
Mine too.
We could save it because I don't... let's move on to your...
We'll save True Grit for when we get to its highest position. So, your number six.
My number six, again, we talked about Kick-Ass, and I last night rewatched it.
I don't get it. Discussion. I don't understand Kick-Ass.
Per our discussion where you said, I don't like Kick-Ass.
That is not so true.
He's like, what's the big deal? It was stupid. I like Jonah Hex. I rewatched it to see, like, okay, was I just caught up in this crazy thing? And I still...
And I wasn't.
I was not. I still think it's such a great movie, and I think it's so...
I would like to announce to the listeners that I triumphed! My critical opinion triumphed!
I think it is so misunderstood, and I hate to be the person who says, like... This isn't directed at you.
No, no,
the
no.
People who I hear who shit on that movie.
No, why would I be offended?
I want to say, because you didn't shit on it. You said you liked it.
No, take a leak.
The people who shit all over that movie, I want to just tell them, like, I truly don't believe you get it. And maybe that's a douchey thing to say. Maybe they get it and they reject it, but I don't think they do. I think it's up there with Spider-Man 2 and The Dark Knight as one of the best
Spider-Man
comic book
2 is one of my favorite movies.
As one of the best comic book movies ever made.
I'll have to rethink this.
And again, I'm not as into the comic book movies as these two, but help an old man out. Spider-Man 2 is Doc Ock, right?
Correct.
That's my favorite of the series as well.
Yeah.
Kick-Ass, if nothing else, it makes me want to see it again. And I want to kind of even talk to you guys more up off the podcast about it just because...
No.
Everything
only
is recorded.
On mic.
On Mike, our other contributor to this movie.
He's going to lay down, and we're going to sit on him and talk about Kick-Ass.
Sweet. He has requested that we pronounce his name on McKay. He conveyed that to me. My number six film, and I was surprised it didn't get more attention because it was out, and then it was gone. And in a weird way, even though the films don't have a lot of similarities, I thought this film was The Kids Are All Right done correctly. The film is Please Give.
Yeah.
And... it's terrific in every sense of the word, in everything that The Kids Are All Right is trying to do in terms of a small, intimate drama about a specific group of people. I thought Please Give...
Particularly women.
I thought Please Give was more insightful and more realistic and more entertaining. And I thought the funny stuff was funnier.
Every scene in that movie is good and interesting. All the performances are great. I think Nicole Holofcener, who made that movie, has gotten better with every movie, and every time I see one of her movies, I realize that I like her a lot more than I realize that I do. I thought Friends with Money was great, and I thought this one was even better. It's higher on my list, and for a long time this year, it was my number one, because it was really the only really terrific movie that I thought I saw, except for maybe Kick-Ass.
Well, I think you'll both be happy to know that... The Kids Are All Right is coming in Netflix in the mail, I think, today.
Oh, good.
So
all right.
I'll be able to watch that
and then
understand
and then
why
watch
I
Please
should
Give,
watch. Yeah, Please Give instead.
And see why it's way better.
I haven't
People
seen
need
Please
to
Give,
see Please Give.
But I want to. John, do you have that on your Blu-ray shelf?
I have to check.
Is this a dream?
You can't...
Shit.
You can't buy everything. At some point, you have to give up being the library. Number five.
Number five is, for me, for Doug... is The King's Speech. I saw that in the theater. So all my reviews to start. I saw that in the theater, and I had no expectations, and I know it's, like, obviously on people's 10 best lists, and now I know why, but I saw this, like, you know, critically acclaimed movie that I heard so much about, and I saw it with no expectations, and I really, really enjoyed it. And I was kind of concerned that it might be that British... I think, John, you
a
put
a masterpiece
it.
Theater
yeah.
homework assignment.
And just the Oscar fodder. And I really, I liked, Colin Firth's performance was awesome. It was just amazing. And I also like the time period. I like the World War II era. I like the understanding, like, why things happened the way they did. And even, I'm not a fan of necessarily the monarchy or anything like that, but I do like to, it's very interesting. And I think it's, if you, for me at least, I love history, and it's like, I want to kind of understand more about that, and they do it in such a way that doesn't feel like homework. It felt like this, you know, fluid thing that I'm learning about but also really enjoying.
And some critics have been putting it down, suggesting that it's a made-for-TV movie with great performances, but I think it's a lot more than that. Although before the podcast I was discussing this with Doug, that one of the joys of the film is in the performances, in that, for instance, Helena Bonham Carter and Colin Firth convey very specifically, with no dialogue to this extent, just how in love they are and what a wonderful marriage it is, as opposed to the other sort of royal marriages that we see throughout the film that are kind of creepy.
Yeah. And loveless. And yeah, Helena Bonham Carter is great.
She's likable when she rarely is right, in a movie.
Yeah, she's usually awful. Abrasive and even cast in such in those roles. But I thought she was there are little scenes between the two of them where it's so obvious that she loves him so much and she'll go to these great lengths to do this for him.
I've seen it show up on a lot of 10 best lists also, and I wasn't surprised to see that because, again, it's like, well, this movie is engineered for that. It has that pedigree, but I went to see it and I appreciated the fact that the film doesn't just coast on that it still tries to be good and entertaining and say something. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
That's some very funny dialogue. Your number five.
My number five, we've covered at length, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, a movie I still probably need to see a few more times before I can fully absorb it. But it's great, and Edgar Wright continues to be awesome.
And my number five film is Get Low, which, again, came and went.
Yeah, it sure did. I missed it.
And, again, maybe this just goes to show how old I am, but I thought Bill Murray and Robert Duvall would be enough to get people to the theaters. But I think the film is slow. The film has a deliberate pace. The film, more than any other film this year, to me, felt like a novel, much like No Country for Old Men a couple years ago, that I felt that I was very much watching a novel transferred to film that was willing to take its time and make some interesting points about how difficult it is for some people to forgive themselves.
Yeah, I liked that movie a lot, and it surprised me as well. That was one of those that could have gone in my number 10 spot. It was in, it was out, but it's really good and underrated.
But you rather have Iron Man 2 as your number 10.
I preferred Iron Man 2.
And this is where they turn the podcast back on. They fast-forwarded to this part after turning off, since I mentioned that.
So now we are on number 4.
My number 4 is Scott Pilgrim. Just mentioned, obviously. I saw it in theater.
It's all just going to be various configurations of the same movie.
Well, this is where we make it at an hour, because now it speeds up considerably.
Now you said you already talked about this movie.
But Scott Pilgrim, I really enjoyed, and I think that if I have any problem with Kick-Ass, and again, I'm still not sure if I have cracked that nut in my head, Scott Pilgrim, I have no problem with. I think it does exactly what it said. It does what it does. It does it wonderfully. I also think Jason Schwartzman's performance, he is awesome in everything he does. He's the funniest non-comic actor out there, I think. And I really enjoyed it, and it's great.
And we now have a chance of making the hour, if only Fat Boy can keep his finger off the magic button.
I don't appreciate being called Fat Boy.
We're effing a whole year if we go over an hour.
You can't. Number 4.
My number 4, we just talked about, it's Please Give. Everyone see Please Give. It's really, really great.
And it will give you a chance to see an actress I'm willing to bet you haven't seen in a really long time. I'm trying to remember her name.
Amanda Peet.
Dana Plato.
No, no, no. Dana Plato is not in the film.
Dana Plato's not with us.
The elderly neighbor.
Yeah.
Played Millie, the next door neighbor, on the Dick Van Dyke Show, on the original Dick Van Dyke Show, and she gives a very wonderful performance.
This movie is going to be ignored at awards season. It's not going to get a screenplay nomination. It's not going to get any nominations for acting, even though everyone is really great and really kind of subtle. And there were so many instances in the movie where, having seen a lot of movies, I thought I knew exactly how things were going to play out. But Nicole Holofcener is too smart and doesn't insult our intelligence and doesn't go for these stupid movie moments.
And every time you think you know what's going to happen, that's not what happens.
Right.
And that's rare in movies these days.
Well, isn't there a thing, too, with the whole, like, award season ceremony Oscars garbage that's like, for example, True Grit, as you pointed out, Haley Steinfeld, I think her name is, who plays
the
lead.
Like, what's the deal with my dad being murdered? What is the deal with this snake bite?
That's Haley Seinfeld.
Oh,
that's easily the best joke of the podcast. Thank you for that. That's excellent. I love that.
Thanks.
But she is obviously the lead. She is the driving force of that movie.
Right.
And
but
she will be
following the Timothy Hutton formulation where, because she's young, that's a supporting performance. But the real reason is she's much more of a shoe-in if they get her the nomination.
Exactly. You can make a case that Christian Bale is gives a lead performance in The Fighter.
I mean, I just, because the more I think about that, the more it just drives me nuts. It's just like,
they're going to
like
relegate them. That they think they're going to win, you know?
Right.
You know, Natalie Portman kind of has Best Actress sewn up right now. So.
And it seems to me that Sandra Bullock needs another Oscar for The Blind Side again. I think it's up for another Oscar this year for...
It's so good.
It's I recorded that on my DVR and then deleted it.
Good
because
for
I
you.
Just was like, really?
Good I'm not for going. You.
Yo, Mitchie!
You made a social gesture. Where are we?
I have no idea. Your basement?
We're at number four. Did
and
you do
your number
four?
Four was?
I said Scott Pilgrim. He
said, please give.
Okay. My number four, thank you for reorienting me.
Let's go back to number 10.
I'm the
my
only
number
person.
10 was the 10.
My number 10 was Ramona and Beast.
It's just two jokes over and over again. An hour's worth of two jokes.
As a joke on iTunes, call this the Ramona and Beast podcast. And won't people be surprised? My number four film is True Grit. And not just massively entertaining, but I would suggest that True Grit stands the chance of being overlooked just because the Coen brothers are now at the point where it's effortless.
Yeah.
If you think about the number of ways that film could have gone wrong, and you can see the number of ways that film could have gone wrong by watching the original, which is American Cheese, which managed to get John Wayne his Oscar for the iconic scene where he puts the reins in his mouth.
You know what's funny about the original True Grit? It was on AMC the other day, and I watched most of it, actually. It was just on as I was doing stuff. In the end scene, there's the one line that's famous that you impersonated at the theater. What is that line? And please do the impersonation.
He saved my life twice. Once after he was dead.
Which, by the way, is more John Wayne than the way John Wayne delivers it in the movie. Because it's just like, he saved my life twice. Once when he was dead. I swear that's how he
said
it.
That sounds like a Japanese film that's been dubbed in English.
Once when he was dead. But it's so quick, and I'm like waiting for this line, and it's like, no, I want, I saved my life twice.
Pilgrim. That's the line I remember most from watching it, like, on the 3:30 movie when I was growing up.
And I didn't know Bobby D was in the original. That's
Bobby D.
And Glenn Campbell, who, of course, then enjoyed a prolific career in motion pictures.
I just saw it recently for the first time. And I didn't know that Kim Darby plays the young girl. And my introduction to Kim Darby was in Better Off Dead, where she's the crazy mom who makes the raisin jello that crawls off the plate.
That boy was a girl in the original True Grit?
She's a boy. Sleepaway Camp. My number two.
Hey, Bobby Reba.
Where are we?
Well,
Doug's
number
at number three.
Number three. My number three is Inception. We'll save it.
Three is True Grit, and I echo JB's sentiment that they just make it seem so. I almost got angry watching it because I'm like, wow, they really make this seem easy. They're so effing good at it.
They are excellent.
And I wanted to hate it so that I could say True Grit, more like True Shit. But it's awesome, and I loved it, and I wish Jeff Bridges could win another Oscar.
I thought, hands down, it was the most entertaining movie of the year.
Do you
so good.
Have an issue with the scene where he's riding Blackie too hard and he shoots, or wait, spoilers. He shoots his mouth off at the horse named Blackie in the head.
No, because throughout the film, he's shown to be a character who often makes that decision to do that, usually to people.
I'm just saying if any feedback was negative, that's what I heard. It was like, I didn't like that scene. I've heard some people say that.
Again, Don't take into account if it makes sense in the movie. It's just like, I don't like when bad things happen to cute things. Like, well, then it's not the movie for you.
And my number three film is The King's Speech, which I'm required to put there because I'm an English teacher and it speaks to the importance of language.
It was excellent. My number two is Black Swan.
I thought for sure that was going to be your number one.
No, it's not.
So I was wrong.
Please.
I'm so happy it's not his number one.
Yeah, I know you are. But no,
I'm
it's my number.
I'm now breathing a sigh of relief.
Gah, gah! Is that a swan?
Yeah.
That's
a swan,
it sounds when I sigh.
I saw Black Swan.
In the theater?
In the theater. Let me just paint you a picture with my painting brush.
Ooh.
I went to see it in a theater in Skokie, and it was a weekend, and it had been a while since I'd seen something in the theater. And I was not looking forward to it because I don't like to be around people. And this theater was very crowded. with lots of different types of people, old and young, and they're all annoying the piss out of me. Mm-hmm. And the lights were, like, dimming. People were still walking in and, like, shuffling between. And it's, like, it was very annoying.
Stressful.
The movie started, and aside from one scene in which, and if you watched SNL this past weekend, there was a sketch about the Black Swan. And in the sketch about the Black Swan, the dance instructor asks a male dancer, would he F the cold, you know, Natalie Portman character? And it's funny on the it's very funny in SNL.
Very, very funny.
In the movie, when he says that, someone in the theater was like, hell yeah!
Oh!
And that's the only part. I was sucked out. I was sucked out of the movie at that point, and it really, really pissed me off, because otherwise, and this is all I'll say about this movie, because I know that JB hates it with a passion, and I really, really like it. My experience was so visceral and so subjective, obviously, that I sat down there, I watched it, I was entranced by it. I really just, the music, obviously, and it doesn't hurt that it's the Swan Lake music, and it stood the test of time. I thought Natalie Portman's performance was great. I kind of forgot where I was, and I really enjoyed it. So,
and that's the reason we go to movies.
Thank you.
My number two, we've talked about, it's The Social Network, a movie that I think is great. It's great. I want to see it again.
And my number two film was also The Social Network. So, based on an agreement we reached before the podcast began, if any of our films were actually in the same slots, Patrick now has to make love to me all night long.
I really liked in The Social Network the rise, and I mean, there was no fall.
The rise of Taj.
The rise of Taj. Just the journey, you know, and how, like, it is, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg, for better or worse, is a very, I mean, very smart person. He's a genius, and I just... When you think about these people with these ideas and the way they do things and the way it makes you think about your own life in such a way. And that's what, I know that's kind of silly, but I watched The Social Network and I just thought about, like, what am I doing and how am I living this life and how is he doing it? And I'm not saying it's the right way to do it, nor am I saying that that is the way I want to be, but it just causes me to reflect.
It made scenes of people writing computer code compelling and interesting.
And that's not easy.
No.
He's also wired in.
and this is just a personal aside. The Social Network also showed me that I'm really glad I'm not on Facebook. And sometimes I feel like I'm the last person alive who's not on the Facebook, which is what I will still call it. But I agree with Betty White in her SNL performance. From everything I've seen about the Facebook, it looks like a tremendous waste of time.
the night I saw Social Network, I saw it in the theater. And it was the night it opened, and there was very obviously a group of, like, 14-year-olds that came in and stayed for about a half hour. Because, like, oh, it's the Facebook movie, and we're on Facebook all the time. And then they got bored, and they left, and I felt better.
Smart people talking? Yeah. Don't need to see that.
I have a story about those girls.
Oh, what is it?
Who are they? The girls that went to the theater?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck those girls. That's my story.
We're at number one, Douglas. Your choice for the best... Not movie, but film of 2010.
In a theater?
Yes.
Wow. Ramona.
Finally, it all converges.
it's just one mashup.
In a theater.
Say Ramona and Beezus. Yeah.
Matter becomes antimatter. And Doug's number one film is?
Toy Story 3.
A sequel?
A sequel.
Are you kidding
a
me?
A threequel.
A squeakquel?
A freakquel. That was not rehearsed.
I listened to your podcast last week, and I realized that
it says with disdain. I heard what you fucks had to say.
I listened to that thing that you call a podcast.
It was amusing at best. I sat in my computer chair. I have a computer chair, and listened to the podcast, and I realized that you both consider it to be overrated.
But still,
I think
very good.
That what it does well, it does so well. And it makes me think that sometimes Pixar, with the exception of Cars Who Are Spies, is the only company who can make movies consistently. They have
a lot of home runs.
They put this together, and it's all these characters, and obviously it benefits because we know these characters. There's no more introductions. But also Toy Story 2 had that also. Like, we don't have to get to know the toys and understand, why are these toys talking? Toy Story 3, I also realize... the story is similar in a lot of ways to Toy Story 2, and that, you know, and that's any movie, I suppose. The things it did well, it blew me away. There's a couple scenes near the end where, if you haven't seen this movie, turn the podcast. No, keep the podcast going. Listen no matter what. Even if I say spoiler alert, keep listening.
Even if I say I love Iron Man 2.
Too late.
You guys are mean. There are scenes in which I teared up when they were about to die. And also the last scene where they're playing with the kid.
When they do die.
When they die. When they're playing with the devil. I teared up. I'm like,
those toys went to hell?
Those toys have a heaven and toys are Christian?
Toy Story 3 to hell and back.
And I realize there's different scenes affect people differently. In fact, we talked briefly before about how there's one scene in which the mom goes into the room of her son and the son is going to school, and you as a newer father and you as a father of a college kid, that scene affected you. Of course, me as a cold, empty, newly married,
black-hearted,
sterile. You're like, yeah, empty room. More room for my garbage.
Yeah. Kids. Kids are poop. That scene affected you.
Toy Story 3, kids are poop.
But I think that the movies work so well because there are scenes that affect everyone differently, and I just... It speaks to so much about, I don't know, toys?
There's no way that movie should have worked as well as it did, obviously, yeah. Like a part three.
And that's even
having something new. It, you know, on the surface, it's like it's just an obvious cash-in.
Yeah.
But, you know, Pixar has gotten so good that no one really wrote it off as such going into the movie. No one said, like, oh, great, a third.
There was a part,
quality story. Standard
there was a part of me that was like... I'm sure this will be good, but I was blown away just by, like, the end. When it ended, I sat in my car driving back home, and I talked to my wife, and I said that I don't, like, why can't every movie be this great? Because I feel so wonderful right now, mm-hmm. and I'm just responding, and I haven't seen it since. I own it. I want to watch it again really badly, but I've been busy watching all the catch-up movies for this podcast. The joy I felt, and I really mean that, it was just pure joy watching that and leaving it and just... shaking my head at, like, you know, just how great movies can be.
Why can't all part threes be that good?
Especially.
And so much of what you just described is my reaction to my number one movie, which is Inception.
Inception 3.
Inception 3.
To hell and back.
Inception 3. You're dreaming, buddy.
Dark Lord rises. I really loved that movie. And again, Doug and I had this long conversation the other day about movies and the higher up the list you get, the more that it becomes about your reaction to a specific movie. Obviously, you know, the movies are arguably higher in quality, but at the same time, there's these sort of intangible things. It's easy to say Social Network is a better movie than Inception because Inception has too much exposition or whatever. You know, a lot of people have a lot of problems with Inception, but I just really, really loved it. And when it was over, I was almost out of breath at what had been pulled off.
Right.
My number one movie is Inception as well. And I think that's a movie that does so many things so well that it sands me that there are critics who seem to be casting about for something to say against it.
That's not how I dream. Well, that's not... The movie isn't about how you dream, fuckwad.
True. But without resorting to potty talk...
You're all fuckwads.
I'm seeing critics say things like, I wasn't involved with the characters, yeah. Or that the minute they see that Inception probably does 10 things right, they expand the net to find a criteria
right.
in which it possibly fails. It's an amazingly ambitious film. I think it succeeds as a sort of musing about philosophical matters. I think it succeeds as an action film. Groundbreaking special effects, something to chew on, riveting, exactly like what you said. It's, 2.5 hours?
Yeah.
It's a 2.5 hour magical spell.
I think that people should listen because when it came out, you guys did a podcast on Inception.
That's right, we did. And you can find it at fthismovie.blogspot.com.
Or fthismovie.blog. What did you say?
Blogspot.com.
That one. And on iTunes, although it might be pushed off on iTunes at this point.
Yeah. Also, there's a new web address, www.ramonaandbezos.com.
.biz.
.biz. .com was taken. Do you think it'll win all the awards?
I don't think it'll win hardly any awards.
No, I don't either.
You don't think it'll win Best Picture?
No.
What do you think, Will?
Social Network.
What's that? Did I see that? I don't remember that movie. Inception was good.
Inception is great.
This summer, I thought it was a shoe-in, but now I'm scared.
The tide has turned, and, well, you know, when it came out in the summer, it was the first good movie, really, that had come out, and so it was like, oh, my God, it was that, you know, it's a big gulp in the desert. But then the back half of the year has been better, I guess, and...
Because this year was pretty shitty.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it wins, like, best editing, best sound design, best, you know, some technical awards.
The MAME awards?
Yeah. Well, that happens sometimes. That's the Academy's backhanded compliment.
Yeah, I don't think it'll win any of the major awards. I really don't.
That's a shame. I really did think it was going to win Best Picture. I put it at number three on my list, and it's probably one of the smartest movies I've ever seen. It really challenged me to think, but it wasn't in such a way that's like, I don't get it. I don't, because it's like, there's not that much to get. It's just, it's making you think about something.
Right. It's, you know, it's great. We have Christopher Nolan, who has done a series of good, smart movies, and then makes The Dark Knight, which is a comic book movie, but obviously way better than your average comic book movie. And it makes a boatload of money. And he takes all that cachet and goodwill, both from the studio and from the audience, and instead of just cashing in and doing, I don't know, another Batman movie or some piece of shit.
A shot-by-shot remake of Psycho.
Right. He does this original thing that is going to stand alongside, you know, Blade Runner as just this watershed movie. I really think that. I think it's really great. And it's one of those things, like, sort of how you experience maybe a little bit with Toy Story 3 or Black Swan when you hear us, you know, saying one's overrated or whatever. When I hear people, critics in particular, talking about Inception and how it's emotionally cold or it's hollow or it's just pure exposition strung together or it's too long, or they're not talking about the movie that I saw. I can't rep. There's movies that I love that you can criticize that I'll say, yeah, I get that. But when I hear the critiques of Inception, I truly don't understand it.
And those critiques make me want to ask, have you ever seen a movie?
I want to go home and watch it right now. That's like how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
Like, I really
if only you had a copy of it.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
My honorable mentions, obviously, Ramona and Beezus and Trash Humpers.
Did Donkey Punch come out this
year? That's a great double bill. Donkey Punch, no, last year.
That movie
year.
About a donkey punch?
You know, the Donkey Punch movie where someone gets donkey punched on a boat.
My wife made a top 10 list. The only two movies that we haven't mentioned that she put on were Youth and Revolt and Harry Potter. And I'm like, really? But I love you anyway.
Also, all kidding aside, we'd like to thank everyone for listening to the podcast in 2010.
Yeah.
And this is the last one because we're never going to do another one. Goodbye, everybody, forever.
Forever? Bye. That means forever, forever.
Bye. Forever. You put the computer away with the Inception noise. You'll just have to make it yourself.
Forever?
Bong. Bong. Wait, the top just toppled over. It stopped spinning. We have our answer. We'll be right back.